Hello. Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to ByteRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.byteradio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp. Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my very special guest, returning guest, is Kyle Davies, and we're talking about his new book, The Intelligent Body, Reversing Chronic Fatigue and Pain from the Inside Out. Why are we seeing growing numbers of people suffering from debilitating chronic symptoms of pain, fatigue, inflammation, and cognitive impairment that medicine is failing to resolve? A new paradigm is needed where we understand the mind and body as an interconnected flowing system. This paradigm embraces the self-healing, self-correcting, and self-creating natures of our connected mind-body system. This book explains the origins of chronic symptoms and outlines the road to recovery. Readers are offered life-changing principles and practices to regain harmony in their lives and bodies, whether they suffer from chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, adrenal fatigue, trauma, depression, or anxiety. It explains how we can learn to heal ourselves from the inside out by reconceptualizing the relationships among our bodies, minds, and emotions, embracing the full importance of the mind-body connection, and tapping our natural restorative capacities. For more information, you can visit Kyle's website, which is kyledavies.net, and that's kyledavies.net, and I do have a direct link to his website in the show page description. So with that, I'd like to welcome Kyle to the show. Good day, Kyle.
Well, hello, Robert, and thank you very much for having me back. It's been a few years, hasn't it, since I was on last?
It has been quite some time, and I follow you on Facebook, so I'm right there with all of the wonderful information that you share with people. But
it's very nice of you to say.
Well, you're one. Now I've had literally hundreds of guests, but not every guest that I'm connected with on Facebook do I follow and have their posts kind of show up on my feed. I usually reserve that to those who share good information, and you're one of them. And that's one of those things that I find it's really important, to spread the word. So,
well, it's very kind of you to say. I appreciate it very much. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. So, The Intelligent Body, congratulations on the new book.
Thank you for that as well. Yes, very exciting.
What was, your inspiration? What was the seed for this particular book?
It's about planting seeds, I suppose. I've spent the last 15 years working with sufferers of chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, and related disorders. And it's very difficult because we are – health and medicine, it's a funny thing, isn't it? I think from my experience of it, we are seeing more people suffering from chronic health problems, be it anxiety, depression, fatigue, pain – autoimmune things, cancer, heart disease. There's more and more people suffering, and which is weird in a way because we know more about the human body than we've ever known. There are more treatments available than there have ever been. We spend more on healthcare than we ever have, yet there seem to be more people that are sicker. So that raises some interesting questions, and I think there seem to be a huge variety of viewpoints as to what is health, what is a health problem, what is wellness, and it's quite difficult to kind of cut through all of that. Now, it's I guess there's a couple of points, really. One is that I suppose I feel that despite all the fantastic things that conventional Western medicine does, it tends to be very good at treating symptoms that are acute. So if you have some form of injury, you know, last year I injured my knee and I needed surgery, or if you have a virus or a bacterial infection and therefore have some acute symptoms, medicine obviously is absolutely amazing at dealing with those sorts of things. But when it comes to problems that are chronic, and we're seeing more and more chronic health problems, medicine doesn't seem to be quite as competent at dealing with those things. And I think one of the issues that comes with medicine, or there's probably a couple of issues for me. One is that there is this focus on treating symptoms. And I think that that tends to leave us reasonably passive in the healthcare process. So if we have a headache, we go to our doctor asking him to take to give us a pill that we can take. So there's that part of us being passive. I think the second concern a little bit for me is that the biomedical model was born out of the idea that symptoms and disease are the result of injury or infection. So medicine tends to look at the body as a machine, and it's kind of broken down into its constituent parts. You know, so if you have a problem with your knee, we're just going to focus on your knee. And I went to see a specialist who deals with knees. And of course, for the sort of problem I had, that was absolutely fine. But when we're looking at chronic problems, the segregation of specialists that we see within medicine, I think, makes it a little bit tricky. And the fact that the body is just treated like this machine, and we focus in on the specific symptoms, almost all also makes it tough. And of course, we know as well that the pharmaceutical industry tends to be where the majority of money or funding for research comes from. So the skeptics out there would say the pharmaceutical industry is not really looking to cure problems. It's looking just to deal with symptoms, because that seems to be good for business. So that's kind of Western. This is a very protracted answer to your question, but I'm trying to answer it in a protracted way. So that's the one issue. I think for me, despite the fantastic things that medicine offers, there are flaws. I think as well that what I'm experiencing is that more and more people are interested in their own health, and people are becoming empowered, and with availability of information on the internet, people are able to find information, are often more informed than their local GP or doctor. However, I think that in terms of the evolution of healthcare, where we seem to be at the moment is there is a fixation on what I would say is food and fitness. So there are lots of people that believe if their nutrition and diet and supplements are right, that is a panacea for all health issues. And whilst I'm in favour of good nutrition, I'm very much in favour of exercise, I don't believe that those two pillars are the be-all and end-all. I don't think if you've got those two things sorted that you necessarily are absolutely sorted and your health is perfect. I'm a believer that many of the chronic health challenges that we're seeing are the result of what I would say is invisible stress or chronic hidden stress. And a huge amount of that is what I would say is emotional stress. And this is really, you know, kind of where the book comes from, is that it's my desire to share this information, because I feel it feels to me that more people are interested in this notion of stress, this notion of emotion and the role it plays in our health. But I think what is vitally important is, because the words of emotion and stress are used so frequently, that people have their own preconceived ideas of what these things mean. And because the biomedical model has had us believe that mind and body are separate, often the words stress and emotion are kind of consigned to a mental phenomena. And I think what I'm trying to do in the book is explain that actually stress and emotion are, they're not something that is all in the mind. You know, the mind and body genuinely are not separate. And we need to understand that in order for us to take, you know, further steps. And it's possible for our bodies to be affected by stress and emotion without us being aware that that is the case. And when they are affected and we're not aware of it, over time, it is this impact that results in many of the symptoms that we see for many of the chronic health challenges that we see. So that's the sort of inspiration behind it. I mean, I've been working, as I say, for probably about the past 15 years I've been working for 18 years as a psychologist in therapy. So I started off, you know, with training in a variety of modalities, and I was working with anxiety and depression. And it was 2002 then I expanded my work and started working with a team of other people, a team of doctors and academics and whatnot, where we were focusing specifically on, at the time were called medically unexplained or functional symptoms, which are the likes of you know, pain, fatigue, migraines, irritable bowel problems. And what I suppose the other inspiration behind the book is that what we wanted to do, and you know, going back through the early 2000s, 2004, 5, 6, 7, we were seeing great success with the work that we were doing, and we felt that even though you know, we didn't have all the answers, even though the therapy that we were practicing was evolving and developing, we felt that, you know, people need to know about this, and also it needs to be researched. And I went on a quest to try to have somebody conduct some independent research, because obviously we couldn't research ourselves, and it was unbelievably difficult. And that it surprised me in a way. And I talked to a whole variety of academics within the UK, asking, you know, whether they would be interested in doing some independent research, because we'd been to government, and the feedback from government was, well, if you want this work to be embraced within mainstream healthcare, then you have to have a randomized control trial conducted. And before you do that, there's got to be some independent research, which obviously you can't do. And in my chats with academics, there was obviously academics who are sort of interested in their own career, really, and of course they have to follow the money. So there was not a massive amount of interest. There was some interest in the work that we were doing. There was one particular academic that was very interested, really thought that we were onto some big ideas, but said to me that, you know, it would be very, very difficult for me to secure funding, because he said there isn't, within the UK, there is no money for new ideas. So I became pretty disillusioned. My business partner at the time had been a GP, and he'd come back in, and then latterly went back into being a GP. But I felt that, well, if I can't, you know, if we can't get research done to have the work publicized that way, I need to write a book, because, you know, I feel that, you know, there's the colleagues that I have, I feel that we're doing valuable work. We're helping people, we're spreading the word, we're trying to empower people and teach them that they can, by understanding these principles, they can sort of take charge of their own health. But I felt a book really would be a way of reaching people on a whole other level. So that's a very, very protracted answer to a question of what was the inspiration behind the book, but it's been coming for some time.
Yeah, well, you know, there's first of all the ideas that you had been working with. I mean, those are things that really need, you know, to be out there for people to really understand. And you know, I wanted to kind of go through some of what you said in a little bit more detail. excuse me. First of all, you know, when you talked about symptoms, you know, that the right now it seems that medicine or treatment really is symptom focused. And one of the things, and you know, when it comes time to recognizing and treating disease, so many times we fail to look for the cause. We really kind of jump toward symptoms. So with the idea that, you know, that medicine or treatment programs right now deal with symptoms, aren't symptoms that aren't they a visible manifestation? I mean, aren't they the kind of the outward signposts for an individual to recognize that there is something wrong, something out of whack, that they kind of really need to focus on? I mean, so in a way, aren't symptoms important?
I think you've, as far as I'm concerned, I concur with that completely. I think symptoms are very, very important. I think that everything we feel in our body is important, because I think this is the vehicle, if you will, that we're having this experience on Earth with. And in much the same way as if I'm walking down the street and a stone pops in my shoe, my body sends me a symptom of pain to alert me to that fact. So that symptom of pain is serving a purpose, because the stone is causing my vehicle, my body, damage. So yeah, I'm a firm believer that everything that we feel, every symptom that we experience, is a messenger of some sort. So it's not so much the idea of focusing on symptoms, it's the idea that we have of viewing symptoms as sort of bad, evil invaders that we're trying to eradicate as quickly and as painlessly as possible. So my belief is that we need to pause for a minute and take a look at that symptom and say, well, okay, why is the symptom there? And of course, in some instances, a symptom can remain after the cause has gone. You know, I've experienced back injuries in the past, and my personal experience of that is that a minor injury can result in the back going into spasm, and there's displaced pain, you know, up the back, down the legs, and taking some anti-inflammatories and painkillers to deal with that displaced pain can be pretty useful, especially if you're debilitated by symptoms in that way. But I think, you know, with that in mind, I'm still aware that, okay, well, there's an injury that's happened, and I need to be mindful of that injury. And of course, the back going into spasm, all the muscles going into spasm, essentially is trying to protect that injured area. So sometimes I think there are times that we need, you know, to treat the symptoms as well as doing something about the cause. I suppose my view is that in Western culture, our desire seems to be to get things done as fast as possible and as painlessly as possible. So if a person has a headache, they're immediately reaching for painkillers for that headache, even if that headache sticks around for a week. And, you know, my view would be, right, well, that's fine doing that to a degree. However, it's worth also asking the question of, why is that headache presenting itself in the first place? What is my body trying to tell me? What message is my body trying to get across? Because in my experience of it, what generally happens is that when we suppress a symptom, when we work directly on a symptom to reduce a symptom, if the cause remains in place, the body will generally just push another symptom forward. It's almost as if the body is saying, well, if you're not going to listen to this symptom, I'm going to send you something else. So what I've experienced working with over the years with people with chronic health problems, chronic pain, chronic fatigue, and these sorts of things, is that people generally they don't wake up one morning with either chronic fatigue syndrome or fibromyalgia. They tend to get worse over time, and symptoms tend to be cyclic. So they tend to kind of come and go, a little bit like hunger. So, you know, if you're hungry at midday, you feel a mild rumbling sensation. And if you don't eat, we know that kind of subsides. And then they'll probably come back later on, a few hours later, and probably be a little bit more intense. And, of course, if you don't eat for 5 days, the symptoms, if we can call them symptoms, or the feedback sensations that we receive will vary, and they'll become more intense over time, even though they'll come and go in cycles. And if we were to do something, if I took a tablet to numb the sensations in my stomach, what would probably happen is that my body would send me a different symptom. So what I've experienced over the years is that people with chronic fatigue syndrome, very often the body will start by sending some milder symptoms of some sort or another. And very often some remedial action will be taken to try to alleviate those symptoms. And symptoms then may subside, but they then come back, and either different symptoms present themselves or the same symptoms come back with greater intensity. And this tends to be a pattern. And it's usually the case that sort of there'll be almost sort of 2, 3, 4, 5 incarnations of a set of symptoms, a varying kind of modulating, diversifying set of symptoms until people then experience chronic fatigue syndrome or fibromyalgia. It's very rare, almost unheard of, for a person to be perfectly healthy and then wake up one morning with fibromyalgia or chronic fatigue syndrome. I've had a couple of clients over the years that have told me that they believe themselves to be perfectly healthy, and then this happened. And then when we've looked in a bit more detail, there's always been something, when we've tracked back through time, there's always been something that they've experienced prior to that. So going back to your question, I think that it's vitally important that we pay attention to symptoms, but the paying attention to symptoms and focusing on them is recognizing that symptoms are a tap on the shoulder, just as you said, really, Robert, a tap on the shoulder from our body trying to alert us, trying to get our attention and say something's out of alignment here, something is out of whack. Because my belief is that what the issue is that the body is in, certainly with the health challenges that I'm dealing with, is that the body is stuck in a perpetual state of stress. And the little metaphor that I like to use is a stress bucket, that our stress bucket is full, and the main contributor to that is ongoing emotional stress. And I think just while I'm kind of on that point of stress, for me, there are two very, very important aspects that we need to understand about stress. Because again, people often think that stress is that kind of nervous, agitated feeling that you have. You know, my boss has given me too much work and I feel stressed. Or my wife has asked me to pick up the kids and then go shopping, and I've got stuff I've got to do for work. I feel stressed. So there's a couple of points. We immediately attribute stress to something outside of us, but people generally think of it as what they're describing is what I would say is a felt sense experience. And for me, that's not stress. For me, that's an emotional feeling that they are having, which is arising from inside of them. Stress is, so the first important point about stress is that a person's body can be in a state of stress without them being aware of it. Now, the example I frequently use, is just because I like it so much, because it's fairly straightforward, is from a book I read a number of years ago called Healing Without Prozac and Freud. And the author of the book talks about an experiment that he was doing to try to understand the role of the brain and the body in stress, essentially. And an aspect of this experiment was showing people disturbing films. And while he was showing them these disturbing films, he was measuring their heart rate, the blood pressure, and the activity of the emotional part of the brain. And he said they had one lady in with doing the experiment. She was watching the films or this particular film. And he said heart rate was elevated, her blood pressure was rocketing, and the activity of her emotional brain was going into overdrive. And he thought, oh my God, this lady is in a deep state of stress. I better go and check she's okay. So he goes into the lab where she's watching this film, and he says, are you okay? Would you like me to turn this off? How are you feeling? And she looked at him with an element of surprise on her face and said, I feel perfectly happy. I'm perfectly fine watching this film. Now, for him, he felt that she was not aware of her emotional feelings. For me, there was all sorts of alarm bells ringing for that, because, you know, firstly, it shows that it's possible for our body to be in a pretty profound state of stress and us to be completely oblivious to that fact. I would say that she runs the risk of at some point having some form of symptom or chronic symptoms, because her body can be in a state of stress and she's obviously not aware. So I think that's the first very important point, is that stress is not necessarily a felt sense experience. It could be that when that person feels that agitated feeling, that their body is also in a state of stress. So it's not to say that we don't feel it, but I think it's very important for us to remember that it's very possible for our body to be in a state of stress and us not to be aware of it. The other, I think, very important point about stress, and really emphasizes the mind-body point and the mind-body aspect of this, is that the stress response in the body is identical, regardless of whether it's emotional stress, or there could be a buildup of emotion in the body. It could be that we've had a physical illness, such as a bad case of flu or Epstein-Barr or something like that. That will trigger the stress response in the body. Or it could be that we've had a physical injury. We could have fallen down a flight of stairs. We could have been in a car accident. You know, as well as the physical injuries, the body will be triggered into a state of stress. So when I had my knee surgery last year, that triggered my body into the stress response. And as I say, that is absolutely identical to a buildup of emotion. Now, for me, that really encapsulates that idea that the mind and body are one, and that stress and emotion are not this kind of all in the mind idea that people think. So that's when we then, if we go back to this little notion, this little metaphor of a stress bucket, we could say that, well, lack of sleep can trigger the body into a state of stress, poor nutrition, excessive intake of alcohol or other drugs that are not good for us, even strenuous exercise can trigger the stress response. Now, the thing with, say, something like a car accident or a bad case of flu is they tend to be probably reasonably few and far between. When we're looking at things like, well, I know I've got a bad diet, or I know I'm over-exercising, or I know I'm just not getting to bed early enough, those are kind of easy fixes. The trickier one to work with is emotional stress. And the reason that it's harder to work with, from my perspective, is, you know, my belief is that we, from a very young age, we get into habits and patterns where we block our emotion. And when we block our emotion, it doesn't stop the body from producing emotion, but we just stop feeling it. So without wanting to get too kind of academic about it, it seems to be the case now that emotion, in terms of brain structures and what goes on in the body and the brain, if emotion is a non-conscious process. It affects all of the body and all of the brain, but it's non-conscious. Emotion then triggers feelings. So feelings and emotions are slightly different. So I refer to them as emotional feelings, because our feelings follow our emotion. But just as going back to the example of the lady in the experiment, she was proficient at blocking her feelings. Now, what we saw was that her body was still producing emotion, and the activity of her emotional brain was showing that, well, her body is still producing emotion, even though she's not feeling it. So this is one, you know, one of the things that we know is that we can become very skilled at blocking out our emotional feelings. Now, it's my belief that what happens, what results over time, is that there's a rewiring, if you will, that takes place within our brain and body. And when we block our emotional feelings, as I say, the emotions don't stop being produced, but there's a rewiring that takes place. And this then results in some dysfunction within certain brain regions that then triggers overactivity or dysfunctional within the immune system, the autonomic nervous system, and the endocrine system. And then what results from that is the whole host of symptoms that people experience with things like fatigue, pain, headaches, anxiety, depression, and whatnot. So there's a chain reaction that kind of takes place. I simplify it down to the idea that, well, when we have a full stress bucket and the stress bucket starts to get overloaded, our body sends a symptom. So we have to pay attention to the symptoms, but the symptoms are a tap on our shoulder. So symptoms are absolutely vital, but understanding the stress and emotion from this kind of mind-body perspective is also absolutely vital. We have to get past this idea that stress and emotion are all in the mind. We have to embrace this idea that there is no separation. These things are all one. Yes, the origins of diseases can be different, but they are, you know, we have to view stress and emotion from this perspective. I know I'm kind of talking on, but there was another point that came to mind earlier when you were talking about symptoms, and that is that I think one of the things that we do as well, and I don't know why this is, but we view life and we view health in a very linear way. So when it comes to treating symptoms, and, you know, we go back to what we were saying earlier about, well, we have this focus on treating symptoms, we tend to like to have things be incredibly simple, where this causes this, A causes B. And I think that what we're beginning to see is a circular causality where there's almost like a combination of things that can ultimately trigger symptoms. And then this is where my little kind of stress bucket idea comes from, that you could be having late nights, you could be over-exercising, you could have had a bad case of flu, you could have a lifelong pattern of burying your feelings, your emotional feelings. And then there could be something, as I say, you could have a bad case of flu, and that could be the last straw, that could be in our combination lock of causes, that could be the last number that aligns and then opens the lock and boom, you begin to have symptoms. And I think that allowing ourselves to open up to the idea that there could be a variety of causes, and each of those causes could affect each other. Even though that obviously that makes the picture a little bit more complex, I do think we need to move away from this idea of, you know, A causing B. And I think there probably is a movement. I think people are beginning to embrace that. But it's very easy for us to slip into that. Oh, I've got these symptoms. What do you think it is? And people are very often looking for, it's going to be one thing. It's something I've eaten or something I've taken or this or it's that. And it could be a combination of a variety of things. And that's why that little idea of that little metaphor of a stress bucket, I think, can be quite useful.
Yeah, exactly. Excuse me. I want to take just a quick break, Kyle, and then when we come back, I really want to look closer the idea of, you know, this invisible stress. You know, that woman who was able to appear calm and collected, you know, despite, you know, the kinds of biofeedback that was being received. To me, that, you know, that's fascinating, and I want to talk a little bit about how people might be able to tap in or recognize when they are in that kind of condition. Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay, great. Everyone stay tuned. We'll be right back after this brief break.
Hello, this is Robert Sharp. I want to thank you for joining us and hope that you are enjoying today's show. Just a reminder that we have a wealth of information and resources available on our website, www.biteradio.me. There is a calendar of upcoming shows, along with an archive link to the approximately 1,000 shows that we have had over the past 5 years. Our show is available as a free podcast in the iTunes Store. You can subscribe there, or even quicker, there is a link to our show on iTunes on our website homepage. We are also on many social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Pinterest, etc., and we have buttons to those platforms on the top of our homepage. And finally, also on the site is a link to the great products we provide: books, greeting cards, photography, and a wellness store with essential oils and personal and spa products. There is so much for you to explore and enjoy on our website, www.biteradio.me. I also very much appreciate you supporting our guests, and especially today's guest. And now, back to the show.
Okay, everyone, thank you for staying with us. Again, today, my very special guest is Kyle Davies, and we're talking about his new book, The Intelligent Body, Reversing Chronic Fatigue and Pain from the Inside Out. Again, you can find out more about his book as well as his other services by visiting his website, which is kyledavies.net, and that's K-Y-L-E. davies.net. And again, I do have a direct link to his website in the show page description. Okay, so with that, we're back, Kyle.
Well, it's great to be back. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Thank you. Okay, so you know, I'm intrigued with the idea of the invisible stress. You know, the idea of that woman who was shown the film had the outward response of being calm, collected, nothing's going on, but also having that biofeedback saying there is a whole bunch going on. So, and you kind of mentioned that, you know, people may have learned, you know, to be able to, you know, when it comes to emotions, to being able to kind of hide them or disguise them, and then possibly leading to rewiring. So my question is for people out there who may not recognize, I mean, if it's invisible stress, you know, obviously it's going to be kind of hard to see. So how would I know, if I'm my stress bucket is kind of getting full with that invisible stress, if I'm outwardly calm and collected? What are some of the ideas for me to be able to examine to see if this may be affecting me?
I think the first point really is a very simple one. My sense is that as a Western culture, we are very, very thinking and head orientated. So we tend to rush around our days almost in a trance-like state from one activity to the next. And while we're doing activity A, we're often thinking about the next six things that we have to do, you know, the B, C's and D's. So my belief is that we are cut off from our emotional selves, our intuitive selves, our physical body. This is probably why we're seeing huge numbers of people doing mindfulness and yoga and these sorts of things as an attempt to try to get people back in the body, being a little bit more present. Now, I think our natural state is a bit like children. I think there are good things to mindfulness and bad things to mindfulness. The bad thing about mindfulness is it can leave you in a space where you're focusing on something, which generally means that you're staying in your head, because because if you're focusing, there is a narrowing of attention. I think our natural state is to be kind of childlike, which is where we are flowing, where we're kind of engaged with the moment. Our awareness is open, but we don't have that laser-like focus. We're not in our head. We're sort of in our body, but we're allowing ourselves to unfold on a moment by moment basis. We're not. It's just this, you know, this kind of natural open awareness. And for me, that's our natural state. So it's okay. Well, how do we get back there? I think, you know, in terms of steps, we can allow ourselves to be aware of our body a bit more. And of course, we can do this while we are engaged in any other activity. You could be driving your car. You could be peeling carrots. You could be writing an email. Just gently encouraging yourself back into your body and just being from a perspective of just being curious about how you feel. And I don't mean that as a mental exercise. I view it as what I would call open awareness, which is a sort of an expanded awareness where you're kind of aware of yourself. You're curious about yourself. You're curious about just how you feel, what the sensations within your body are. So I think that's the starting point. There is a natural flow to life where sometimes we're daydreaming, sometimes we're very present. I'm not an advocate of forcing anything. As I say, I'm an advocate of that, almost like that childlike state where sometimes you're daydreaming, sometimes you're very, very present, sometimes you're focused, sometimes your awareness is dispersed. Those are all natural states. I think that we can gently encourage ourselves, though, or nudge ourselves to be a little bit more present and just to be curious about how we feel. It tends to be the case that we define ourselves reasonably tightly. So this is who I am. This is who I've always been. This is what I like. This is what I don't like. And it's the sort of, I would say, the mind or the ego that defines us in that way. And I like the idea of kind of being curious about who we might be. You know, just because I've played golf for the last 10 years, it doesn't mean that I'm always going to play golf, but I think a lot of the time people will define themselves in that way. Well, this is me. I'm somebody that likes to play golf. So every Saturday morning I get the clubs out, put on my plus fours, and I go and play 18 holes. And the risk with that is that you may think, oh, so how is that a problem? Well, the risk is that if you know, we have the capacity as human beings to be changing, to be flowing, to be moving, to be different. There are many aspects to us. And if we define ourselves too tightly, then we prevent ourselves from developing. And it could be the case that I change a little bit and actually playing golf doesn't do it for me anymore. But if I'm stuck in my head and I'm tightly defining myself, it may be that I'm not aware that my body is giving me a gentle nudge and through some sensations of tension. Or maybe I'm yawning as I'm going around the golf course because I'm finding it a little bit boring. Unless I allow myself to just open my awareness and be curious about the sensations, the feeling, feedback that I'm having, I'm not going to pick up on that. So that's the starting point, really. It's beginning to practice what I call open awareness, allowing ourselves to be curious about how we feel and simply allowing whatever we feel to be okay. That's, for me, there's a couple of profound points. There were certainly profound things in my life was that because I feel a great deal, when I allowed myself to, and I found that I resisted my feelings. I said, you know, it's very difficult to be sensitive as a male, certainly within Western, within Western culture. So I tended to think of myself possibly as a bit of a pussy, and therefore I resisted and blocked my feelings. And I went through a period of my life in my late teens and early 20s of having a lot of anxiety symptoms. And again, as I look back now, I could see that there was a full stress bucket. one of the contributors to the emotional stress in that was that I was living in my head, and that kind of got worse and worse as I went through college, where I analyzed everything and didn't really let myself feel anything. So I've kind of lost my point there as I've gone off talking about. You might have to bring me back on track with a new question, Robert.
Well, you know, I mean, that's fine. You know, and the idea, you know, and in a way, I'm glad you got to that. The idea of the Western male and emotions and kind of, you know, not expressing, not feeling, and not, you know, fully, you know, embracing the emotions. I mean, that's just one of those things where that we really need to look at. You know, again. With some of the societal expectations of, you know, emotions being generally a female kind of trait, you know, and expression that we really need to kind of be aware, because it seems that when it comes time for that, you know, invisible stress, that it's our emotions not being expressed, and you know, that's the for me, you know, the idea of that open consciousness, kind of being aware, being in the moment, being mindful, you know, that is a way of kind of getting in touch whether or not that invisible stress is happening. To me, that's a great step.
It's certainly a great first step, isn't it? I think I'm really glad you brought up that point on emotion, because maybe because I'm a male, I tend to have a reasonably mechanistic view of emotion to a certain extent. I have a spiritual perspective, but a mechanistic perspective as well. So I view emotion as a feedback mechanism. And I draw on the work of possibly one of the pioneers of the mind-body movement is Dr. Candice Pert and her great book, The Molecules of Emotion. And she viewed emotion as being no different in terms of the biological processes involved. She viewed it as no different from hunger or tiredness. And I think that's a great way of looking at it. So in my mechanistic view, I view it as simply as a feedback mechanism. I think we're wrong to think that emotion is just something that happened in the past, I therefore need to talk about, or to even think that it's something that needs to be talked about. You know, if we compare it with, say, hunger, you don't necessarily have to talk about the fact that you're hungry. You recognize the feeling, the sensations that you have, you recognize its feedback, and then you take the appropriate steps. And I think that emotion is exactly the same. There are times when we may want to express something, but I don't think emotion is something that its primary purpose is for us to talk about it. So my view of emotion is possibly a bit esoteric, but functional as well. I view emotion as, my emotion is about me, and my emotion is there's a few things involved. So it's a navigational tool in as much as it's providing me feedback about my interaction with my environment, but it's also providing feedback about the meaning that I am imprinting upon the world, because there's no real inherent meaning out there in life. We imprint meaning, and then as we interact with life, as we talk, walk, you know, do things, we have emotional feelings as a result of that. So my emotion, ultimately, it's always about me. It's about my journey. So in terms of how do we work with it, my perspective is that my emotion is guiding me back to me. It's inviting me to act in alignment with what I would call our true self. So I'm sort of presupposing that there are, if we take away all the kind of the conditioning, all the nonsense, all the trauma, all the everything else, inside of each one of us is a true self, is a core, is a frequency, is a wisdom, a soul, whatever you would want to call it. I think there's something within us, and if we trust it that aspect of us, that true self part of us, will guide us through life. So my belief is that true self wants to experience itself. And there are many aspects to it. But, you know, for me, one of the purposes of life is that we have the experience of being ourselves, which is kind of experiencing and playing out and unfolding this true self. So I think emotional feelings are guiding us back to our true self. Now, kind of an example of this would be that if I'm, say I'm at work and my boss is trying to get me to do something which possibly isn't actually my job to do, and my body sends me the emotion of anger, the common thing to do would be to say, my boss makes me angry. I would say, well, it's not that the boss or the context is making you angry. It's that the anger in that context is presenting itself to you, inviting you to act in alignment with your true self. And the action, the words or actions that you take in that context should not be to try to get rid of that emotion, because you want to allow yourself to feel the emotion. The emotion is not a problem, and the emotion never needs to be solved. But the action in that context needs to be, ideally, for me to be authentic. So the emotion is guiding me back to me. It's giving me an opportunity and reminding me that in this moment, I need to be authentic. I need to be, as best I can, acting in alignment with my true self. Now, it may sound a bit convoluted, but one of the benefits of that is that I'm empowered. It's my emotion is about me. It's my journey. As soon as I blame my boss, I'm disempowered. And I think it's also a false notion that life causes how we feel. So there's nothing I can do. And I also judge my boss. And when I start judging life, then that tends to amplify the negative feeling experience that I have. So my emotional feelings are guiding me back to me. But of course, there's another factor, without wanting to make things too complicated, there's another factor that the amount of, you know, emotional feelings or just feeling discomfort that I have could vary from day to day. So my boss could do the exact same thing tomorrow, and I may not have such a dramatic feeling experience. And that's because we exist on a spectrum, and our feeling experience is very much impacted by this kind of vibrational spectrum that we exist upon. And the importance of that, I suppose, again, is this idea that, okay, well, it's much more useful to believe that my feeling experience and therefore my conception of reality arises from inside of me. And it's not that life is directly causing me to feel certain ways. Yes, it can be, you know, we can't extricate ourselves from our environment. We're going to be influenced by it. And we know, you know, people that are spiritual are aware of the energies of life and how we can be impacted by the energies of life. But we want to be very clear that we don't want to disempower ourselves by saying, my boss makes me angry. He's a bad person. I don't like him. We want to say, okay, so anger has arisen, and that's absolutely fine. It's inviting me to act authentically. What is it in this? If I'm to be true to myself, what is it what does the true self want to do in this context? So it's very important that we understand that emotion is not just something that is about the past that gets blocked up, and is not necessarily something that we have to talk about. There are times where maybe we do wish to talk about our feelings, mm-hmm. but I think that, you know, I've encountered lots of people over the years. That's the first understanding of emotion is, well, that's something I've got to talk about. Are you saying I've got to talk about my feelings? And I say, well, not necessarily. You don't necessarily have to talk about hunger. You might want to talk about hunger if you're in a group. You know, if you're with your family or a group of friends, you might want to say, well, I'm hungry. How about we go to this restaurant? But so that's the idea. And I suppose that's more of a focus towards men. If men can view their emotion as being something more mechanistic rather than this touchy-feely thing that they've got to talk about, I think it becomes something tangible that it's easier to work with.
Yeah, it would be, that would be the case. But I really like the point that really the emotions are for you. They're to help you understand you better, and get you in touch with, that true you, just basically it's a tool that the body uses to be able to help you better understand yourself and live in the environment that you are. Now, with that in mind, since we're getting down toward the end of the show, one of the things, the idea of the body as being an intelligent being having an intelligent and also having the self-healing, self-correcting. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because, sometimes I think that people don't recognize just how smart our body is and the power that we have within ourselves.
Yeah, I think there's two points I'd like to make on that, two distinct points, I think. The first point on the intelligence within the body, again, I think because we've become so mind and thought and conscious brain focused, we within Western culture, I think we have this sense that conscious thought and intellect and analyzing can solve everything, and it's the highest form of intelligence. And my sense is that intuition and emotion and the body needs to be up there, and we need to recognize that actually they probably play different roles. So we need to analyze, we need our critical reasoning and thinking skills, but we need to understand that in the same way as you don't eat soup with a fork, there are certain things, that you need to have, you need to understand that there are intelligences that are different. I think, the other point on that is that what science tells us now is that we've got neurons in our digestive system. We've got neurons and receptors for neurons in our heart. So there is a flow of intelligence, quite literally a flow of intelligence activity that takes place throughout the body. And this goes back to the work of Candice Pert, because, when she started her work, the sense was that intelligence activity, meaning that there are neurons and receptors for neurons, therefore, if we're defining intelligence as being some information that is, transported from one part to another, and then something happens, it was thought that only took place in the brain. And then when it could be seen that, well, actually, this intelligence activity, so the receptors for neurons and neurons are actually in the body as well. So the idea of having that gut feeling means there's literally intelligence activity taking place within the gut. And it's the same activity that takes place within the brain makes, this a very scientific way of understanding that, okay, well, the body is intelligent. So simply believing that critical thinking and reasoning and analyzing can deal with everything and solve everything is probably not the case, and actually gets us into trouble, because that's when we begin to, as the lady in that experiment, that's when we begin to shut off to our body feelings. And being aware of our body feelings, knowing that how important and useful and functional they are, it's vital. So that's the first point. I think the other bit that goes with that in terms of healing ourselves is that, as I was saying earlier, underneath everything there is this sort of true self. I think as well, underneath everything there is this kind of blueprint for health and well-being. I think our default factory setting, if you will, is to be connected to our true self, is to be vibrant, is to move towards fulfillment, is to experience a degree of peace of mind. I'm not going to say be happy, because happy is an emotion, and emotion is something that comes and goes. So I don't think we need to strive for happiness. I think we need to strive for being connected to our true self, because when we're connected to our true self, life just seems to be better. Good things seem to happen. we seem to, the choices that we make are better, and we tend to have a more of a sense of fulfillment and peace of mind. So I'm in favor of striving for that. But as I say, I think that there is a natural pull, a gravitational pull, for us to return to that default factory setting. And I think that's our natural self-feeling, self-correcting aspect. So in much the same way as if you fall over and you kind of graze your knee and it, without doing anything, it naturally heals itself, our emotions and our natural tendency is to heal and is to, for us to come back to this connection with our true self. I think what often happens is that we get caught up too quickly in meddling and trying to fix ourselves, and we don't give ourselves an opportunity by stepping out of the way. Usually our head gets involved and starts to analyze and all the rest of it, and we don't give ourselves this opportunity just to naturally kind of flourish. So that's the sort of the self-healing bit. Now, of course, you could say, oh yeah, but if I fall over and I have a deep cut in my leg, I need some stitches. Because that's absolutely right. And the stitches, they don't heal us. They just they create an environment where the self-healing can take place. So yes, there are times where we need a little gentle nudge. And that's essentially what my work is about. And that's what is explained and kind of laid bare, if you will, in the book, is that I'm trying to encourage people to believe that, right, well, what we need to do is trust ourselves, realign with our true self. And when we do that, the body kind of naturally heals itself. What happens is that we naturally kind of empty our stress bucket by realigning with that true self. When the body is not stressed, then healing takes place. Because, you know, as we know, if I have just a graze on my knee and it doesn't heal, then it's because my body is in a state of stress, and that's the environment, therefore, is not enabling my body to self-correct. So that's the kind of the key thing, is that we, even when there's a problem, even if it's a chronic health challenge, you know, as I say to all of my clients, we want to spend the minimum amount of time on therapy or coaching. And that minimum amount of time is a little bit like the stitches holding the cut together. It's just nudging a person back on track, so that, you know, giving them a gentle nudge to realign with their true self. And then when they align, the self-healing takes place.
Wow, that's great. Well, gosh, this has really been an hour filled with jam-packed information. So I really want to thank you, Kyle, for your time. I've really enjoyed your information, and I know that it'll be helpful to listeners, because it's going to be helpful to me. So thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Robert. It's been an absolute pleasure to come back on, and you keep up your great work with the show.
Thank you very much. And as people may have heard, you are on Facebook, so that they can join you there. Any other social media applications that they can meet you, or just can they contact you through your website?
Through the website, the other thing I would say about Facebook, I'm on Facebook as Kyle Davis EFC, which is short for Energy Flow Coaching, which is kind of what this method is. If there are any listeners that do have anxiety or a pain or a fatigue condition, there is a Facebook group, and I do a weekly Facebook Live, and that is called the Fatigue and Pain Solutions Group. So it's a free group, and we give loads of info in there. So if you do have some symptoms, check that out. I'm also on Twitter, as my Twitter handle is at Kyle L. Davis.
Great. Well, that's a great resource there, that Facebook group. So I'll definitely be referring people to that. So thank you again for your time. I've really enjoyed it.
Thanks very much, Robert. Take care.
It's my pleasure. Again, everyone, today my very special guest has been Kyle Davies. We've been talking about his new book, The Intelligent Body, Reversing Chronic Fatigue and Pain from the Inside Out. And again, you can find out more about Kyle and his book and his work by visiting his website, which is kyledavies.net, KyleDavies.net. And again, there is a direct link to that website in the show page description. So everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me. That's BITERADIO.ME. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Byte Radio Me, and our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.